Well, now I have a fourth reason, I think, to worry about what I'm going to say after Norman's far too kind introduction. Of course, in military terms, it's very foolish to expose yourself entirely above the parapet. The two reasons are other reasons why I was apprehensive about this afternoon were provided, of course, by our two previous speakers, two addresses of enormous power by Professor MacLeod and Dr. Chaplin. When I learned afterwards, of course, that Professor MacLeod's address had been given without notes, or I think someone told me he'd written two words, I immediately thought of H.H. Asquith, who apparently delivered a two-hour speech on licensing reform in 1910. An admirer asked for a copy of his speech, and a piece of paper was handed over with "too many pubs" written on it. We're all familiar in this part of the world with the phenomenon of whataboutery. So person A discourses on topic X and his interlocutor, person B, replies, but what about X, Y, and Z? It's a fairly significant form or feature of our public discourse here, and it's not normally helpful. However, in a talk entitled "The What About Rights," the temptation to engage in some whataboutery of my own is overwhelming, and on this occasion, and I would say this, legitimate. Let me explain. I don't think it's possible to engage in the discussion of rights, to which the title of this talk commits me, without also talking about justice, about good government, and about the nature of law itself. The question, what about rights, leads inevitably to what about justice, what about government, and what about law? And the interconnectedness of these three phenomena is made clearer in some languages than in others. In Latin, French, German, Spanish, and Italian, to give only some examples, the same word can mean both law and right. English, as we know, of course, clearly uses two. Now, only a few of us, I imagine, and I'm not one of them, will have seen the great fresco cycle in Siena by Ambrogio Lorenzetti, depicting good and bad government and their respective effects. Many of us will have seen reproductions of it and be familiar with it. Indeed, there's always the danger that with paintings that overexposure can lead to the image becoming stale, and the intention of the artist being lost. An image of great power can be rendered banal. In fact, I seem to recall that Lord Lawson, when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, used part of the image of good government as his departmental Christmas card one year. I don't think that's a fate which the 17th century Sienese city fathers could possibly have imagined. In Lorenzetti's allegory of good and wicked government, justice is depicted no fewer than four times. Firstly, under the auspices of divine wisdom, then flanked on one side by a representation of distributive justice and commutative justice on the other side, and then fourthly, on one side of the image of sovereignty alongside temperance and magnanimity. But my point here is very swiftly made. For Ambrogio Lorenzetti and the Sienese government who commissioned his work, justice is an absolutely essential component of good government whose relative importance needed to be visually emphasised. Picking up a theme, I hope not inelegantly, from what Dr. Chaplin said about the importance of Christians using a language which they have in common with those who they are trying to persuade. Aquinas and those who have followed him have accepted the definition of justice given in Justinian's Digest. That is, the perpetual and constant will to render to each one his right. Indeed, it's interesting that Thomas Aquinas accepts this juridical definition over an objection to it based on his beloved Aristotle. The definition comes itself from the Roman jurist Ulpian. Now, the great Roman law scholar Tony Honoré published a study of Ulpian, simply entitled Ulpian, in 1982. When the second revised edition appeared in 2002, that's a significant date because it's some 2 years after the coming into force of the Human Rights Act, it bore the subtitle Pioneer of Human Rights, and not just, I think, to improve sales. In the same article of the summer, St. Thomas quotes Isidore of Seville, who says that a man is said to be just because he respects the right, jus, of others. And parenthetically, therefore, I think it's difficult to sustain the case made by John Milbank and others that Aquinas doesn't recognise subjective right. Now, there is no doubt but that we talk a good deal about rights in this part of the world, and it is not always clear to me that the language of rights, as it is often used here, discloses a clear idea of what a right is. That may be because it's not clear at all that what is an issue it can be a right by anyone's conception. If I want something that a government department can give, a demand for it couched in the language of rights may be thought to carry greater force than a request phrased in nothing more than the language of desire or aspiration. The big question for us really is the philosophical, is a right the philosophical or juridical equivalent of a free fire zone in which a person in reliance on a right can trump any social or moral obstacle to the realisation of that right? A short time ago, the Northern Ireland Human Rights Consortium ran a campaign in support of the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission's Bill of Rights project under the slogan, "Don't be done out of your rights." The slogan carried at least the implication that if the Bill of Rights project proposed by the Human Rights Commission wasn't carried forward by the UK government, then the citizens of Northern Ireland would be being done. Amnesty International members and supporters have been known to carry placards bearing the legend, "Love is a human right." Whatever may be the value of this sentence as a slogan for campaigning purposes, it is of course legally meaningless. But it can help us to examine the idea of right or entitlement possessed by human beings simply because they are human beings. The tradition of Christian reflection about government, of course, sees human beings as possessors of rights. For a Christian, the case for human dignity does not have to be spelled out. Psalm 8 does it for us. Within the Christian tradition, rights are proportioned to the common good. The idea of rights as being some form of free fire zone is absolutely unthinkable in a Christian context. Indeed, and by way of an example, the superfluity of property which a person possesses may be seen by some Christian thinkers as being the entitlement of the needy rather than the unassailable right of the legal owner. In 1997, the then Foreign Secretary Robin Cook famously and perhaps surprisingly controversially said, "Our foreign policy must have an ethical dimension and must support the demands of other peoples for the democratic rights on which we insist for ourselves." Now, the reference to an ethical dimension would, I think, have puzzled Aristotle, St. Thomas Aquinas, and John Calvin, for whom politics was itself a branch of ethics and not merely an activity with an ethical dimension. For Calvin, Aristotle, and St. Thomas, the problem with Robin Cook's dictum would have been that it simply didn't go far enough. Aquinas, again drawing on legal sources, quotes the Roman jurist Celsus, who says that law is the art of goodness and equity. Think about that. Law is the art of goodness and equity. And I invite you again to note the use of purely legal, secular sources by Aquinas, but also more importantly, for present purposes perhaps, to note the gulf that separates the mental world of Celsus from our own. Celsus is no isolated figure. The writings of Cicero, for example, abound in passages that might be found in Augustine or Aquinas. Cicero, in Book 1 of his Treatise on Laws, speaks of what he calls the truth, that we are born for justice and that law is founded not on opinion but on nature itself. It is striking that although there are, of course, differences of emphasis between these writers, there is a commonality between the traditional Christian teaching on law and justice and that of the Roman and Greek worlds. And it's in this context, of course, that one thinks of one of the classic expositions of this, Sophocles' Antigone, and the heroine's invocation of the unwritten laws against Creon. The great Professor George Steiner has put it this way. He says, "It is the unbounded plenitude and depth of implication in the Antigone-Creon debate which have given to the play its immediate and enduring status." These lines are canonic in our Western sense of individual and society. Insofar, Steiner says, as he is a political animal, the notion is itself Greek, it is in these lines that man comes of age. The things that have to be rendered to Caesar had to be rendered to Caesar's predecessors. The obligation that our Lord refers to in all three synoptic Gospels is not a new obligation. It is a new statement of an old obligation, an obligation that antedates the incarnation of the Word. Similarly, when our Lord says in Matthew 5:17, "Think not that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets, I have come not to abolish them, but to fulfill them," his reference to the law is not confined to the old covenant with Israel, but to what a later era would call natural law. Robbery is robbery, whether it occurs in Africa or Europe, and whether in the last century or last week. Now, I want to turn to how legislatures and judges make and shape rights in domestic and international law. And as I've noted, in some languages, the same word, for example, the Latin jus, can mean both law and right. That's not true in English. And I think it's a pity, because it's good to be reminded of right whenever law is being spoken about. Now, I want to set out four ways in which rights can be conferred by national and international law. Firstly, there can be a conferral of an entitlement or right directly by legislation. A good example here is the conferral by Section 1, Subsection 1 of the Freedom of Information Act 2000 of a general right of access to information held by public authorities. Section 1, Subsection 1 of the 2000 Act provides that any person who makes a request for information to a public authority is entitled, firstly, to be informed in writing by the public authority whether it holds information of the description specified, and if it does, to have that information communicated to him. Secondly, there can be a conferral of an entitlement or right by international treaty. Perhaps the classic example for us is the European Convention on Human Rights. Article 3 of Protocol 7 of the European Convention on Human Rights provides that anyone convicted of a criminal offence shall have the right to have his conviction or sentence reviewed by a higher tribunal. Importantly, of course, as many of you will know, in common with other treaties, the European Convention on Human Rights is not directly effective in the United Kingdom. So if I've been convicted in the Crown Court here, I cannot use Article 3 of Protocol 7 to get me through the door of the Court of Appeal. That leads, I hope, naturally to the third way in which rights can be conferred, and that is by the creation of an enforceable duty on A to do X. So A's duty to X can sometimes be said to give rise to B's right that A will do his duty. Such a duty can arise under common law or be created by legislation. When the duty is created by legislation, the drafting technique can, of course, result in such a duty being framed in positive or negative terms. Classic example of the duty being framed in negative terms is Section 6 of the Human Rights Act 1998, under which it is unlawful for a public authority to act in a way which is incompatible with a convention right. So if I claim that a public authority has breached one of my rights under the European Convention on Human Rights, for example, Article 10, which deals with freedom of expression, I don't rely on Article 10 directly to get me through the door of the court, but my lawyers will say perhaps that the public authority has breached its duty under Section 6 of the Human Rights Act because the public authority's actions are incompatible with my rights under Article 10 of the Convention. Fourthly, there may be a conferral of special powers on public officials, for example, the power of arrest on police officers, which can be said to do three things: create a right in the public official to exercise a particular power, impose a duty to exercise the power lawfully, and thirdly, at least an expectation, perhaps even a right, that the power will be exercised for the public benefit and, in any event, lawfully. I'm tempted to almost add a fifth category, that is that we have rights whenever courts say we have rights. Of all of the four ways that I've discussed in which rights can be conferred by positive act, by statute, by international treaty, by the common law, what they have in common is that they can be changed. So what Parliament makes, it can unmake. A treaty can be amended or denounced. In short, what can be given as a matter of domestic or international law can be taken away too. The impression is sometimes hard to escape that in the view of some people, there is something morally superior in a right that is conferred, created, or expressed in an international law instrument than one found, for example, in a statute. Now, it's true that international law treaties are often instruments of great solemnity and the product of very serious reflection by persons of great eminence. But it's also true that one can simply have committees of persons who can be described as, may even be, experts who will set out their views in various instruments with no other authority than that which their supporters choose to give them. And it's curious, at least I find it curious, that persons who in other respects are not commonly receptive to authority outdo the most slavish of Louis XIV's courtiers in their obeisance to the work of committees, provided only that the title of the committee is preceded by international or UN. For instruments which do not have binding effect in our law, that is, most international law, the question must surely be about the quality, the rationality, the fairness of the instrument, rather than the magnificence of the title, or the magnificence of the title which the committee, in some particular case, bestows on itself. But this leads, I suppose, to an important question. Is it really useful to speak of rights having a theological or philosophical origin, or should we simply speak about those and count on those which are expressed in domestic law? Jeremy Bentham, to select only one, famously thought that the idea of natural rights was unhelpful. In his Anarchical Fallacies, devoted to the 1789 Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen, he wrote, "There are no such things as natural rights, no such things as rights interior to the establishment of government, no such things as natural rights opposed to, in contradistinction to legal." Famously, he regarded natural rights as simple nonsense, and the idea of natural and imprescriptible rights as that immortal phrase, rhetorical nonsense, nonsense upon stilts. At the same time, Bentham expounded in his Anarchical Fallacies a criterion which was itself not found in any law for determining whether or not a right should be established, maintained, or abolished. And it was insofar as it, to use the sort of the distilled version, corresponded with the greatest good of the greatest number. Now, Bentham, I don't think, ever committed himself to a crude 51% can annihilate the 49%, but sometimes he may come close to lending himself to that vulgarisation. In contrast to Bentham, I think it's worth setting up the authority of perhaps the greatest political philosopher this island has ever produced, Edmund Burke. Burke is sometimes, and quite wrongly, not considered a supporter of natural law and natural rights. Famously, the War on Hastings impeachment, he had to respond to a defence argument that actions in Asia do not bear the same moral qualities as the same actions would in Europe. Burke said this, in my view, magnificently. "This geographical morality we do protest against. Mr. Hastings shall not screen himself under it. But we think it necessary, in justification of ourselves, to declare that the laws of morality are the same everywhere, and that there is no action which would pass for an action of extortion, of peculation, of bribery, and of oppression in England that is not an act of extortion, of peculation, of bribery, and of oppression in Europe, Asia, Africa, and all the world over." Like Bentham, Burke opposed the French 1789 Declaration, but did so on profoundly different grounds. Burke considered that human beings had rights by virtue of being human, these metaphysic rights, he called them, and that being made for civil society, the rights of persons in society are coloured by the demands of each particular society. Here are two quotations from Reflections on the Revolution in France. "Far am I from denying in theory, full as far is my heart from withholding in practice the real rights of men. In denying their false claims of right, I do not mean to injure those which are real, and as such as their pretended rights would totally destroy. If civil society be made for the advantage of man, all the advantages for which it is made become his right." Secondly, "What is the use of discussing a man's abstract right to food or to medicine? The question is upon the method of procuring and administering them. In that deliberation, I shall always advise to call in the aid of the farmer and the physician rather than the professor of metaphysics." Here, Burke reminds us that a preoccupation with or an insistence upon rights in abstracto may disrupt the role of a healthy political and social culture, and that practical outcomes, that for all human beings, practical outcomes for everyone outside the academy have much more importance than mere abstractions. And I want to say something about the limitations of what law can and should be asked to do later. Burke's emphasis on the authority and responsibility of individual polities to shape laws to their own requirements is an echo of what Thomas Aquinas said in the second part of the Summa Theologica. Aquinas said this: "The human will can, by common agreement, make a thing to be just, provided it be not itself contrary to natural justice, and it is in such matters that positive right has its place. Hence, Aristotle says, in the case of the legal just, it does not matter in the first instance whether it takes one form or another. An example here would be which side of the road we drive on. It only matters when once it is laid down. If, however, a thing is of itself contrary to natural right, the human will cannot make it just, for instance, by decreeing that it is lawful to steal or to commit adultery. Hence it is written in Isaiah 10, woe to them that make wicked laws." Human laws are either just or unjust. If they are just, they are binding not only as a matter of domestic law in terms of legal consequence, they are binding in conscience from the eternal law from which they are derived. And here Aquinas quotes Proverbs 8:15, "By me kings reign, and lawgivers decree just things." Three things, following Aquinas, are required for a just law. Firstly, that it be ordained to the common good. Secondly, that it be within the power of the lawgiver. And thirdly, that it impose proportionate burdens in the attainment of the common good. And against that, laws can be unjust in two ways. Firstly, by being contrary to the common good through being opposed to the things previously mentioned, or when they impose a disproportionate burden in the achievement of something which in itself would appear to be in favour of the common good. Such laws for Augustine, Aquinas, those who follow them, are acts of violence rather than laws. As Augustine says in his book on free will, "A law that is not just seems to be no law at all." Importantly, though, for Aquinas, those laws are not necessarily devoid of effect. Such laws do not bind in conscience, except perhaps in order to avoid scandal or disturbance, public disorder, we might say, because to avoid these causes, a man should even yield his right, according to Matthew 5:40. "If a man take away thy coat, let go thy cloak also unto him, and whosoever will force thee 1 mile, go with him another 2. I'd now like to turn to a recent concrete example of where conflicting models of rights have been publicly examined in court. Christians, and I think particularly in the period after Christmas, are or should be sensitive to the plight of persons who cannot find accommodation. It is one thing, I suppose, to find that there is no room at the inn, but disappointing as that may be, it is another to find that there is no room at the inn for you because of some characteristic that you possess. In November of last year, the UK Supreme Court held that Mr. and Mrs. Bull, a Christian couple who ran a small hotel, unlawfully discriminated against Mr. Preddy and Mr. Hall, a homosexual couple who had booked overnight accommodation in the hotel on the ground of the sexual orientation of Mr. Priddy and Mr. Hall. It was held by the Supreme Court that the right of Mr. and Mrs. Bull to practice the Christian faith did not permit them to reserve double-bedded accommodation to married couples. Bull and Hall is an immensely important case, and it's a very strong example of the clash of rights. The claim, on one hand, by Mr. Priddy and Mr. Hall, founded in domestic law, not to be discriminated against on the ground of their sexual orientation, and on the other hand, the right of Mr. and Mrs. Bull under Article 9 of the European Convention on Human Rights and Section 6 of the Human Rights Act to manifest their religious beliefs in practice and observance. The opinions of the justices of the Supreme Court are of considerable interest, and I commend their study to anyone who's interested in this area. For the purposes of this talk, I want to focus on a single paragraph in the opinion of Baroness Hale. And in paragraph 54 of her opinion in Bull against Hall, Baroness Hale says this: there is no question of replacing legal oppression of one community, homosexual couples, with legal oppression of another, those sharing the defendant's beliefs. If Mr. Priddy and Mr. Hall ran a hotel which denied a double room to Mr. and Mrs. Bull, whether on the ground of their Christian beliefs or on the ground of their sexual orientation, they would find themselves in the same situation that Mr. and Mrs. Bull find themselves today. Now, if these words are intended by Baroness Hale to be reassuring to Christians, I do not think that their intended outcome is likely to be achieved. What is striking in the passage that I've just quoted is, it seems to me, the extent of the failure to understand the Orthodox Christian position. I don't know if Mr. and Mrs. Bull serve meals in their establishment, but if they did so, and if they were to refuse to serve food, for example, to Mr. Priddy and Mr. Bull on the ground of their sexual orientation, that would be not only unlawful, I think, as a matter of domestic law, but also incapable, I think, of moral justification. On the other hand, a Christian who wishes to adhere to traditional Christian moral principles cannot, without committing serious sin, make available premises to facilitate a purpose which that Christian believes to be gravely sinful. To do so, the Christian believes, is to be complicit in the sin that one thereby facilitates. In the passage that I've just quoted from Baroness Hale, she offers, in fact, a false equivalence, and she does not appear to appreciate the nature of the Christian objection. A homosexual couple who ran a hotel would not be troubled on some philosophical ground connected with their homosexuality at the thought of a Christian married couple occupying a room in their hotel. A homosexual couple who ran a hotel would endanger neither their orientation nor any belief connected to it by having a Christian couple occupying a room in their hotel. On the other hand, for a Christian couple to make accommodation which they consider ought to be reserved for married couples, only available to unmarried couples, does violence to their beliefs and makes them complicit in what they regard as deeply sinful. Taking the matter outside the fraught area of sexual orientation, the question might simply be asked: if a Christian couple who refused to let the boyfriend or girlfriend of one of their children share a room with them in the family home, or taking it further, a holiday home, including perhaps a holiday home that was available occasionally for commercial letting, should they be permitted to do so? In question 63 of the second part of the second part of the Summa Theologica, Thomas Aquinas discusses respective persons. It's a rather old-fashioned phrase. We would probably say unfair discrimination. And he classifies it as a form of injustice. If, he says, you promote a man to a professorship on account of his having sufficient knowledge, you consider the due cause and not the person. But if in conferring something on someone, you consider in him not the fact that what you give him is proportionate or due to him, but the fact that he is this particular man, here, remarkably, check this out, if you will, the names which Aquinas gives are, for example, Peter or Martin. then there is respect of the person. since you give him something not for some cause that renders him worthy of it, but simply because he is this person. It strikes me that in a society such as ours, in which there are many beliefs and interests, that we ought to be capable of having a better go at reconciling them. For myself, I see no reason why some boor who, for his own obscure reasons, doesn't like homosexual people should be able to deny services to them as an expression of his own dislike. The law prohibits such a denial of services, and in my view, rightly so. On the other hand, I do think that a Christian in business should not be placed in a position in which he is now, it seems, placed by the Supreme Court decision in Bullen Hall, where she or he must choose between either withdrawing from business or becoming complicit in what a Christian must regard as deeply sinful. In my view, if the legislature were following due reflection to give weight to the right of Christians and other persons of faith to manifest their beliefs in their businesses and professions subject to a general public order limitation, I don't, for example, think that followers of Mithras should be able to slaughter bulls publicly in the high street, then that is likely, in my view, to be entirely consistent with the European Convention on Human Rights. It's important, I think, to see courts as part of government and not as some collective of saintly NGOs, because if we ought to be concerned about unlawful government behaviour, then we think, I think we're entitled to ask two questions. Is it possible for the courts and a final court of appeal or an international court to act oppressively? And if it is possible for the final court of appeal or an international court to act oppressively, what safeguard do we have against that oppression? If we don't like what our MP or MLA does, we can try to change them when polling day arrives, and elections are also the way in which we formally and potentially effectively hold the executive branch of government to account. What if we don't like what judges are doing? Because there is a class of judicial decision where no appeal is effectively possible and where the decision has a considerable social, economic or political impact. As I've said, if I don't like my legislators, I can try to change them, but I cannot, as a citizen, hope to change my judges. In the US Supreme Court, both of the other branches of government are involved in judicial appointment. There is a trend in Europe to confine judicial appointments to commissions, often with judges in a majority or with significant influence, thereby further removing any citizen involvement in judicial appointment. One view is that where judges are in a majority or are likely to dominate such commissions is that it could even be said that judges appoint judges. And I think of this in the context of the controversial decision of the House of Lords that rocked the Irish Presbyterian community in 1844. This is the decision of the Queen against Millis, in which it was decided that a marriage solemnised between a Presbyterian and a member of the then established church by a Presbyterian minister was invalid. There was an even split among the Lords who sat and heard the case, and the appeal therefore fell with the result that I've just mentioned. Now, the decision has been regarded by legal scholars as almost universally as wrong, indeed as laughably wrong, but it hasn't been formally overruled. But Parliament moved swiftly to remedy matters by legislation, including passing interim legislation while the appeal was going from the Irish Court of Queen's Bench to the House of Lords in the 1840s. And I wonder if a comparable decision in terms of its harmful social effects were to emerge from, for example, the Court of Justice of the European Union, we would find, I think, that Parliament's ability to redress the grievance would be much more limited than in the mid-19th century. So I now want to say a little about the limitations on law, in terms of the practical limitations, the burden, the extent of the burden that we should ask law to do for us. During the controversy about the expenses of MPs, the then Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, was quoted as saying, "Westminster cannot operate like some gentleman's club where the members make up the rules and operate them among themselves." Well, it does seem abundantly clear that there was much to object to in the rules then applicable to members' expenses. I think that if the culture of the club, to use Gordon Brown's word, had been opposed to the drawing of lavish expenses, then by and large, lavish expenses would not have been drawn. And that would be irrespective of the particular content of the rules then in force. Indeed, in many ways, a club was perhaps the worst example that the then Prime Minister could have used. Many of us will be familiar with clubs with a healthy culture, and in these, the rule book tends not to be particularly well thumbed. On the other hand, many of us will have experience with clubs where the spine of the rule book is broken from frequent consultation, and I hazard that we will find that they are not the happiest of places. Aquinas, in the first part of the second part, question 96, invoked the moral propriety of yielding to an unjust law to avoid giving scandal or causing disturbance, relying on Matthew 5:40-41. Equally, it may be more moral to refrain from claiming or insisting upon something to which one is entitled, something to which one has a right. An insistence or an obsession with the exact content of the law has long been recognised as harmful. Cicero refers to what he calls the trite maximum, summum ius, summa injuria, hard to translate, but I suppose maximising law is to maximise harm. Instancing how harm often occurs from very skilful, malicious, but by implication faithful and accurate interpretations of the law. Law shouldn't try to do too much. The third constitution of revolutionary France, that of the 22nd of August 1795, is prefaced by a declaration not only of rights, but of duties. No bad thing. You may think, and I'll say a little about the role of duties in a minute, but I want to draw attention to Article 4 of the Declaration of Duties. This reads, "No one is a good citizen if he is not a good son, a good father, a good brother, a good friend, a good husband." Setting aside for a moment, if I may, the comic potential that might exist in the French assigning the last place to being a good husband, and also setting aside that there is little to dissent from in the sentiment of that article, the question that surely arises is how is such a duty to be enforced? Am I in breach of it if I forget my sister's birthday? Perhaps that's a bad example. Is Dr. Chaplin in breach of it for having sent his brother a flippant birthday card? The extent of the obligation is truly totalitarian. It purports to impact on each and every one of the identified human relationships and to measure the quality of those relationships. And that strikes me as something which is simply unthinkable as a task for law. Happily, that was a short-lived example of a law trying to do too much. St. Thomas Aquinas, in his commentary on St. Paul's letter to the Romans, gave prostitution and usury as examples of the law putting up with evils that were too difficult to enforce without causing greater disruption. No doubt the angelic doctor would change his mind about at least one of those matters after a conversation with Lord Morrow. Between 1940 and 1942, the French poet Paul Claudel meditated on the Book of Revelation. And some 10 years later, he published his reflections on the Book of Revelation. Commenting on Revelation 9:20, he says, "Socialism, capitalism, human rights, racism, these are idols much more indestructible than any that have ever existed." Claudel is, of course, no unwavering authority. In the early years of the Second World War, he wrote a poem in praise of Marshal Pétain, and at the end of the Second World War, he wrote one in praise of General de Gaulle. You can guess which one made its way into his collected verse. But the point, there is a point, I think, to be distilled. We might differ with some of his characterisation, but there's no doubt that an obsession with capitalism, with socialism. Racism is the easy one for our generation, with human rights. Is not that capable of becoming an idol? I think there's something worth reflecting on in that regard. Coming towards a conclusion, let me commend to you the following as a statement of, I think, correct principle. Individual rights, when detached from a framework of duties which grants them their full meaning, can run wild, leading to an escalation of demands which is effectively unlimited and indiscriminate. An overemphasis on rights leads to a disregard for duties. That came from Benedict XVI's encyclical letter, Charity and Truth. I don't, of course, commend it to this distinguished body as papal teaching, but as reasonable, and I would suggest readily confirmable, by our own daily experience. Of course, I'm a lawyer and not a theologian, and therefore, by way of professional bias, I'd like to end not with a theologian, but with a lawyer. Ulpian, who, as I've mentioned, defined justice in a way that has remained relevant. And again, striking that a lawyer's definition of justice is the definition of justice that, that theologians have had recourse to. I'm aware of no significant theologian who's written about justice who doesn't in some way work from Ulpian's definition of it, which is contained, as I've mentioned, in simply the standard Roman law collection produced at the in the 6th century. Ulpian himself producing his books in the 2nd. But after, as I say, defining justice in a way that's been useful to us many centuries later, he goes on to say what the core precepts of law are. Law, jus, which also, of course, as I've mentioned, means right. These are, according to Ulpian, the central precepts of law: to live honestly, to harm no one, and to give each person what is due to him. So, not merely perhaps as a publisher's puff, he can indeed be truly described as a pioneer of human rights, of a balanced and fruitful philosophy of human rights, as necessary now, I think, as it has ever been. Thank you very much.